tonight on Arena, Enda Walsh and Anna Malarkey on Safe House, their show for this year's Dublin Theatre Festival, and what happened when Dylan Thomas came to visit County Donegal in 1935. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. Enda Walsh is a multi-award winning playwright, director and screenwriter. Anna Malarkey is a composer, performer and producer whose music varies in style from folk to jazz to electronica. Anna and Enda have now collaborated on a song cycle, Safe House, which will get a fully staged performance at the Peacock Theatre next month as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival. Delighted that they're both with me in studio this evening, but they have been together on this programme previously back in 2022 at the Galway International Arts Festival when Anna played this song from her debut album. There we have it, Falling, the title of the song that Anna Malarkey sang for us. It was 2022, it was the Galway International Arts Festival, and I do believe, Enda Walsh, you who were in talking to us about medicine with Donald Gleeson, I think, was that right at the time?
Is that it?
Yeah.
No, do you know what? I think it wasn't. I think it was the first child. I think I was...
Oh,
it was
the operas. The operas.
With Tunica, but it was the same year,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
That's right.
And Anna was in performing music live, and she performed that very piece, which you hear on the album in all of its technicolour glory. But I remember your face when that... when that piece was playing.
Yeah.
Do you remember
I remember
the emotions?
Because the thing about it is like, I mean, this idea for doing a song cycle has been in my head maybe for about sort of 7 years, and it's gone through a couple of sort of, you know, I couldn't find anyone to really work with. And I had heard Anna's music before. And then when she was on your show, I was sitting beside Dunica and I went, oh my God, there's Anna Malarkey there. And we were looking at it, and then she sang. And as soon as she started playing that song, I went, that's it. That's the sound, and that's the feeling of, like, I think what this song cycle should be. And then, you know.
And it was that immediate, the kind of...
Immediate. I just saw, I think I turned around to my associate and I just said to Owen Garrick, and I just said, oh my God, this is like, I think I've just got to approach this woman sort of with, you know, like an idea of what this is, and hopefully she'll sort of like, she'll...
Do you remember the approach then, the subsequent approach, Anna?
I do. I remember it very well. Yeah. It was the day after the album was launched. I got an email and it was asking to meet for a coffee to discuss this idea. And you had sent me a sheet, a Google Doc of an image and a small write-up around the character.
That's right.
And her place. And
so what was the image? The character is Grace, who we learn a little bit more about. But what was the image? Do you remember what the image was?
Yeah, it was a handball alley. The handball alley specifically, I think, in Barna.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
This is an incredible piece of accidental stuff, if you like. So you knew a handball alley near you in Barna.
It was actually a 12-minute walk away from where I lived, yeah.
That's right.
As did you, Enda.
Yeah, because when I saw it, because I've been in Galway sort of so many times, and I like go swimming up in Silver Strand, and anyone in Barna will know that handball alley. And I was standing in that handball alley years and years ago, and I said, oh, I'm going to base something here in this place. And, you know, ideas kept on sort of coming back to me. And I worked on different shows, but that woman in a handball alley in the middle of sort of like Barna and how she got there just sort of stayed with me. So that's what arrived, this very one pager and a picture of this handball alley. And then we started.
Yeah, really. you started on the work of that. And did you start the handball alley, and did you knew Grace? Did you have Grace, the character,
yeah,
in your
head?
Yeah,
I just had one. I knew I wanted to do sort of like one character, and the idea of a show that sung was interesting to me. I mean, I like sort of work that isn't so literal and that leaves space for an audience to piece it together. So the piece is structured, sort of fractured in this way, and we hear, you know, her, you know, it's only her, and she sings, but there are voices from her past and film. So the idea of doing a sort of theatre stroke sort of like broken film, stroke sort of like whatever else, you know, just came to me. And I thought, well, that was the starting point. But really, there were just sort of, I think I suggested a little sort of ideas, you know, like scenes from her life that, you know, that could be potentially songs.
And that as a starting point for you, Anna, how unusual was it? You know, here's a kind of a fragment of a scene, or here's the title of a scene as Enda's describing it to us there. I'm not sure what happens. He may even have said, but this is the kind of feeling around this song.
Yeah, for me, that was just so exciting that it was like, it's so open that, like, you know, sometimes it, as a composer, I'll have like fully finished pieces that you compose for. Mm. Whereas this felt like very different. It was very open. There was, you weren't like, Anna, I want this genre. I want you to do this style for this thing and this scene. It was like, here's a character, here's her space, here where she is, where she exists, and here's fragments of memories that she's having. How do you respond to that? Which is like such an exciting piece to work with.
Yeah, the openness of it was the attraction. And it is, there's a staged aspect to this. There's an actor or singer on stage performing the vocal part of it. But there are a lot of visuals in theatre, you know, it's been happening for a while.
Yeah.
But these are very specific films. They're very atmospheric films. I've seen a couple of them only online, but it'd be lovely to see them up on the screen in a stage setting.
Yeah, we had a sort of, I think we had a, like a, we did a very sort of busy sort of 2-day shoot. We built a set in the Peacock Theatre and sort of shot in there. And but yeah, I think they're just sort of their images and scenes from her, you know, and from her past, and you piece them together. You piece together her sort of family life in this little town, and da da da, and her, and all of this, and her relationships with, you know, like a boyfriend perhaps or whatever. And it's, yeah, I mean, they come at you the way that I think sort of memories do, in a very sort of oblique way, very sort of like fractured way. But I think over the course of, if they want to, over the course of the piece, I think an audience will begin to sort of pull it together, stick it together into chronological sort of order, you know, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, there's a kind of a narrative there, but there is a space left for the viewer or the audience member to kind of piece it together in his or her mind and decide what they want it to be. However, let us go back to 1988. I do believe. Was when Pat Kenny was commentating like this.
Well, I have to tell you that we employed Agatha Christie to write the script for tonight. We have a very close situation. I'm not sure if we can have a quick look at the top five again, but there's 5 points in it, I can tell you, between the United Kingdom and Switzerland. So can Scott Fitzgerald hang on by the skin of his teeth, or will Celine Dion catch up? She's only got to make up 5, so it's all to play for. Everything depends on Yugoslavia, and we're going now to Ljubljana to get the final vote this evening. Good evening, Yugoslavia. Good evening, Ljubljana.
Thank you, Auntie.
Ask Olga, Grace.
For Mahagos, Auntie.
Good girl. Quinny Ortlishan Wilge. And take it home, eh?
Sha. Take one, Auntie.
Absolutely beautiful. That's a 1 minute fragment from within the several fragments.
It's sort of like, you know what, Sean, I mean, I've done like shows before, but I've never done a show about a person's whole life.
Yeah.
And I know this is a young woman. I think she's probably, when we see her, it feels like she's about sort of 30, but it feels like a very complex sort of like detail. And it feels very, very large and very special that, and you know, that she's sort of, That we got her, I think.
Yeah, so obviously the voices here. This, we're talking about Safe House, which is, I don't know how to describe it. You know, a song cycle doesn't say what it is. I think your own descriptions, I think whoever came up with a song cycle, a gig and a smashed up memory play kind of does describe it, whoever came up with that. But so there we heard this 1988 Eurovision Song Contest, the commentary by Pat Kenny, obviously there. Then you heard delving off into a new area and the voice of this young girl who we presume is Grace at the age of whatever, 10 or 12, something like that. And then Moira Negreanu as the Aunt Jean. Ken Faw. on Gaeilge. Why did you want the Gaeilge in it, Anna?
Yeah, tá sé simúl. Pius Gaeilge van, just mar tá sé sais, I suppose, muhi and sé kind of suller on clan Ataiki. So it's kind of giving something about her family and her history in her family.
You get that real texture of a family that, and it, you know, the auntie speaks in Irish, and you know something about the family that you know make up your own mind what that is.
And I think that's something that's so special, is make up your own mind. I feel like it's so, there's rud uskultia. Mm. Is there on drama? Like, there's definitely an openness.
Yeah. And also, though, I don't know whether you picked up on this from what you saw on screen or from the scenarios that Enda gave you. You give us a quite a dark, mysterious kind of underlying music bed there.
Yeah, and it's definitely not the darkest track.
No.
But, like, I think there's a real fun... There was a lot of fun to be had in having these sort of really big electronic scores and then blending classical music with them. And I think that was something we talked a lot about, is like character as sound, character as place, character as person, character as character. Mm. And I think character as sound has that divide between electronics and classical largely. And the electronics can go to places that are really dark and deep, but also can bring us to a nightclub, or, you know, bring us to a different context. And the cello you heard there was sort of the Anne's theme, so right. The character in instrument.
And that presence of the Irish for you, and
did you just hand that
bit over to Dan, as it were?
I mean, this, we're dealing with a homeless young woman, a woman who sort of like leaves home, leaves a sort of small town, ends up in Dublin. But I think the last sort of month of her life, I think she was in Dublin, or maybe the last sort of 4 months, and she ends up in Barn on the west of Ireland. And I don't know. I think it was the piece is sort of like, I mean, there's a lot of trauma and a lot of sort of sadness in it. And there was just something really beautiful about the Irish and the connection with the dad in all of this.
Yeah, because we hear the dad's voice, and he speaks an Irish Cawill too.
Yeah, so does the aunt. Yeah, it's all this sort of thing. While the other side of her family, the mother is a much more is a darker, sort of more broken woman, I think. But anyway, I don't know. I don't know how it came about. I don't know who suggested, but anyway.
But it did beautiful. Strike me as we're talking, and as you say, that the character of Grace has this marginalised feel to her. She certainly come from a difficult situation. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't say too much about it because I know I'm not allowed to. But I did see a screening of Small Things Like These the other day.
Yeah.
And that darkness, the treatment of women in particular, seems to be a theme. It's certainly there. And I know it's Kilroy's book, but Clare Keegan's book, I beg your pardon. Yeah. I know that it's there in the book, but that theme seems to interest you, and I presume was part of the interest in the screenplay in the first place.
Well, I think, you're right about the sort of the treatment of women and the treatment of sort of young women, particularly in this sort of small town. And our piece is probably set in like mid 80s, right? And sort of early 90s and all that type of thing. It's sad. I mean, this is why I wanted to sort of work with Anna. It felt as if, like, I mean, I'm a middle-aged man and all that sort of thing. I wanted as many women as possible on this piece to tell that story. Anyway.
There's another scene a little bit further into the piece from, because there maybe four or five different film sections. I'm not sure exactly how many there are.
Yeah, there's many.
Yeah. There are many film sections. But this, again, features a little bit of voiceover.
Yeah.
The creepiest voiceover I've heard in a long time. Oh, yeah, I'm delighted that you're surprised to hear what section this is. Let's have a listen. You'll know why I'm saying creepy in a minute.
What are you sitting out here for? You come home with me, yeah?
Sat on my bed and spat.
you want to stay, Grace, you'll have to give me something. You understand, yeah?
And there we have a scene from Safe House, which Enda Walsh and Anna Mullarkey are speaking to me about tonight. I think that scene is referred to as Hot Bath. Mm-hmm. Even that is creepy when you hear the context of that. How did you describe
I think it's just a book around town. I think it's sort of, well, anyway, when people sort of see it, I think it's this person, this poor Grace, who just feels as if actually she's found love and what love means to her and all of that and, you know, how it arrives to her.
Yeah, and the lyrics within that. How did that work? Let me go to you in this one, Anna. Because the lyrics within that talk about the single becoming two, and there's a real sadness in the way that is expressed. Did you come with lyrics? Did Enda come with lyrics? Was it a joint effort? How did that come about?
Some of the pieces I was given lyrics first, mm-hmm. and some of the pieces...
You arrived with music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that one had lyrics first.
Yeah, I think so.
Because there's a feeling that she's a bit drunk, so the music needed to have a little, like, mm-hmm. a swing in it. And then, but there's a sensuality in it. Mm. So how do you, like, my thoughts were, how does this express itself sonically? The words, how do we find the textures and timbres to, like, match that feeling?
So in as much as anything else, you're talking about the character of the song are talking about the character of Grace.
It would change a lot, Sean. I mean, I would sort of write some lyrics to sort of songs, and then the music would come back, and the music from me would really push me sort of lyrically to respond later on in a different sort of song. There were great sort of, like, she was really pushing the music, and I felt as if, oh my God, these songs are opening up, into sort of, you know, verse, chorus, first chorus, whatever, sort of middle eight, whatever. They were just became very different, you know, but I knew they were going to be.
And again, when we hear the male voiceover with the, you know, you want to come home with me tonight or whatever exactly it is, he said, and then you give us that, is it a marimba?
Marimba.
Yeah. And it's so creepy, which is normally quite a happy little instrument, the marimba, isn't it?
Well, that's nice. It's nice to, like, I think there is a juxtapose a lot between, uh-huh. again, between light and dark. Like, so something that might feel light might not necessarily be light. Mm. And I think that that's true for Grace's world and her reality. So the instrumentation needs to reflect her perception a bit.
Yes, yeah. And also we should point out that was you singing, because it's Kate Gilmore who will be performing live on the stage of the Peacock over the run, but that was you performing there.
That was actually, that was a rough draft of me singing the melody, yeah.
Yeah, that was really, really bad of the Abbey to give you that, actually. But anyway, I'll have words with them later on. Don't you worry.
No, but, I mean, it really gives us a wonderful atmosphere, though.
It is. It's terrific. I mean, it's sort of like you're right. It's the atmosphere. This is what we're finding in the rehearsal room. I really think it's all down to the music. The immersion for the audience, this character, this world that they created is really quite amazing.
And again, it strikes me, the idea of opera as the total work of art. Mm-hmm. That's really what you're looking at here across a song cycle. It is a stage play. It is a film set, or it is a thing with projections. It's an installation in some ways. You could have it in a handball alley, which would be very interesting. And it is a straightforward song cycle. It really is a mashup.
It is. I mean, it was like, as I say, it was sort of, it's been about five, almost maybe even 7 years in the making when we'd made some theatre pieces and then, like, you know, these operas with Donica, which are a great experience. And the lighting designer that I work with, Adam Silverman, just said, let's do a song cycle. And I went, oh my God, what a song cycle. Right, okay. And the notion of sort of, like, you know, these over the course of like an hour and 25 minutes, these songs will sort of add up to something that I think is like someone's life and a big theatre sort of like experience. And yet it's just song. I've done a couple of sort of one person shows before, but it's something really strong and immersive because when the story is passed through just one character, and I've got to say, it's like, I mean, this has been probably the best rehearsal experience I've ever had. It's like, and the strongest because it's, you know, going into the room with sort of Kate Gilmore sort of singing at you sort of every day, singing these songs. And it's just like, it's really quite extraordinary for me, I think.
Really. And was that decision there from quite early on, and whichever he is willing to answer, that the Grace character would sing? I don't think she speaks a single word. She sings everything, doesn't she?
One word, I think.
Yeah, she speaks one word.
Yeah.
Well, and possibly that's a word that we shouldn't utter. Or is
that maybe one word. Yeah. That was always the idea. Right?
And Kate is just amazing. Because, like, some of these, that particular track is, like, it's actually really hard. like, because some of them are written, like, you know, I'm listening and I'm singing a melody and I'm reading words. And some of those melodies and timings, I wasn't thinking of, like, you know, how easy or how hard it was. It just needed whatever I could find to be right for the words. And, like, Kate is playing a blinder. Like, she just, she's just incredible. Her ear is incredible and her singing.
Yeah, because, I mean, there are times when, and that section was one of them. Let's face it, in a lot of operas, when you hear recitative, you think, oh, here we go. Here we go. Is it going to tell us what we need to know for the next lovely song when it comes along? But somehow, that section, for example, which has, it isn't verse, chorus, rhythmic lines, it has the openness of spoken, singing, speaking, recitative, but yet it still has enough melody that it's interesting to listen to.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's actually just been so fun. I feel like we've just had a lot of fun over the last 2 years making, like, something that is very poignant and very dark and very true, but while having a lot of play, you know? Yeah. Like, it was really, for me, it was really open and free.
I think when you pass it through one character, I mean, the character really sort of, and you listen to them close enough, they really define everything. They define the sort of the story, but also they begin to define the shape of the music, right?
Yeah.
So the early on, we're sort of trying to find what the style is. And then after a few songs, if you're true to that, then the character really begins to sort of shape, you know, what needs to happen musically.
Yeah, because there's some songs that are, you know, they're not electronic and they're a song. There is a song in it that's like a traditional song.
Yeah.
And it's sung and played as a traditional song. And that's what Grace needed at that time.
So. And yet when, you know, and all I've seen, again, I have to say, all I've seen is, you know, 7 minute segments of two or three of the images, the short films that are put up on. And those short films, each one that I saw had a full and complete story within it. You know, it told a big part of Grace's background. And I'm wondering that idea of having, you know, the people screen with at times 5, 6, 7 characters up on screen. And the lonely live figure on stage, that must...
I mean, we're going into tech next week and I'm bringing that side of Jack Phelan's sort of like, you know, video into that work. He's doing one storytelling and Kate and, you know, us are, you know, like doing the other thing. So like marrying both of those things is going to be... It's going to be really, really fascinating.
I was wondering about the technical rehearsals and how difficult those few days will be.
Well, it's sort of like, you know, we're very, very good at tech because, like, musically, like, in the past and also sort of from a sound point of view, they're so locked in. They're such technical shows that I'm obsessed with sound that actually we arrive really sort of, like, ready. And then it's just that it's just fitting sort of Jack stuff in. It's really sort of, like, sort of detailed kinetic sort of work. Mm. And more than anything I've done, this is like locked in, sort of like to the sort of sound.
And it did, I believe, Anna, you had great joy and play with the orchestra that you had for the sound, establishing the soundtracks for the films.
Stop the lights. Like, what a dream come true. And I got to...
What did you have at your disposal?
Well, so first and foremost, I just want to say Elaine Kelly, who conducted, was just the absolute best and is so inspiring and just so amazing. And she was the one who got all the musicians and did a lot of the hard work of planning and scheduling and understanding how to condense a lot of songs in 2 days.
Had you orchestrated them? You know, had you suggested the orchestral parts that would Kate conduct?
I wrote them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we had like one of the pieces that has like maybe a bigger ensemble is the last track, and it has, was it like 9 flutes, a piccolo? The piccolo really does it for me, like, you know. and then we had like a timpani, which was so cool to see, just like right close to a timpani, that's amazing, yeah. And like a string quartet, and then a woodwind ensemble with clarinet, bass clarinet, and yeah, just beautiful. But yeah, Elaine really, I feel like, and then also a vocal ensemble of like the whole range.
We hear kind of a grumbly male chorus in there as well, don't we?
Well, they've got a beautiful song. Really,
yes.
Beautiful.
Oh, they do. There is a pure vocal piece there. Yeah, it was really special to be part of it. Sort of, I'm just like, sometimes I'm just like, whoa, how did we get here?
Well, you've got to go in and do the technical rehearsals and get the, when I just can't find the full detail on my sheet in front of me, it's my fault. When exactly are you opening, etc.? Is it the?
I think it's about. God Almighty, what is it?
So it's the third.
Oh well, with done,
the preview
Anna.
Is the third, and the actual opening is the 8th.
Yeah.
And the show runs until the 16th of November, as we had 2 weeks added recently due to high demand.
I saw that
Anna, that's really impressive.
And
where's the website that I can find the detail? DublinTheatreFestival.ie. I don't expect you to know that.
Oh my god.
DublinTheatreFestival.ie will give us all of the details. Listen, the pair of you, Enda Walsh and Anna Mullarkey, I'm so delighted I saw you. Somehow in my head, you weren't here, but you are physically here, and I'm delighted that you could be. And best of luck with it all. Looking forward to seeing it enormously.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sean.
Now, competition for you this evening. On Tuesday, the 1st of October, Beatrice and Benedict, Berlioz's sparkling adaptation of Shakespeare's classic comedy Much Ado About Nothing, will be performed at the National Concert Hall with narrator Fiona Shaw and starring Irish mezzo-soprano Paula Murrahy. We have a pair of tickets with a pre-concert light bite at the Pen and Player restaurant, plus an overnight stay at the Green Hotel on Stephen's Green in Dublin. To be in with a chance of winning that fabulous prize, you will text your own name and the answer to the following question to 51551. We'll announce the winner at the end of tonight's programme. In 1993, a film version of Much Ado About Nothing was released, starring Denzel Washington, Keanu Reeves, Emma Thompson, among many others. But which Belfast-born actor, winning screenwriter and actor, Oscar winner, I should say, Oscar-winning screenwriter and actor, adapted the play for the screen and directed the film? Who directed that film version of Much Ado About Nothing back in 1993? Text your own name and the answer to 51551 and you will be in with a chance of winning that particular prize later this evening. I'll announce the winner before the end of the programme. In 1935, a very young Dylan Thomas found himself on retreat in Glenloch, a remote spot in West Donegal. I kid you not. At the tender age of 19, Wales's most famous literary son found sudden and extraordinary fame on the publication of his first book of poetry. Unable to cope with it, Thomas found himself living something of a hedonistic life in London, running up debts to pubs, evicted by his landlord, and most definitely not focusing on writing more poetry. His publisher spirited him off to West Donegal in a bid to get the young poet back on track. How he got on there is the subject of a new play by Sean Byrne. The play is called One Night in Glenloch. It opens this Thursday at the Ballard Arts Centre in Ballybuffet, and I'm delighted to be joined on the line this evening by the director of the piece, Charlie Bonner. Lovely to have you with us this evening, Charlie.
Hello, Sean. How's it going? How are you?
Not bad at all. I have to say, this was news to me that Dylan Thomas came to any part of Ireland, but particularly to Glenloch in County Donegal. There is a semblance or a large chunk of truth in his visit at any rate, is there?
There was an artist called Rocco Kent from America who came over to Donegal in the mid-20s, and he fell in love with the place, and he ended up taking an old disused kind of donkey shed barn, and he kind of fixed it up and created a studio there, and he did loads of wonderful landscapes and everything from the area, and he went back to America and ended up doing a lot of illustrations for stuff. But he had caught wind through a mutual friend of Dylan Thomas, Jeffrey Gregson, who was Dylan Thomas's publisher.
Yeah.
And Dylan, at this stage in 1935, had just become an overnight success. And he was 19, and as every 19-year-old, didn't know what to do with himself. And he kind of began hanging around with a lot of what would you call, I suppose, artistic ne'er-do-wells, and started losing the run of himself. And he had more than, he had one book published, but they had two more to do. So he had the second album to write. So they decided they're going to have to extricate him from London and take him away somewhere so he can gather himself together again. So they suggested Glenloch, which is like at least 10 miles away from any other human being. And they sent him off there, and he spent 3 months there writing poetry and trying to gather himself together and and try and find new muses. So that's what happened.
Was that visit documented in some way? Did he write about it? Was there talk about it in local circles? How did Sean Byrne? Sean Byrne has obviously imagined part of this for the sake of the play. But how much of this encounter in Donegal between, it must be said, Dylan Thomas and a guy called Liam the Post, who we'll come to in a minute, how much of it is totally imagined? How much of it is based on some kind of documentary evidence?
Well, it's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. He managed to keep his notoriety going. He went to Ardrah on numerous occasions and ended up leaving when he finally did leave Glenloch and the area. He left a lot of debt and a lot of bad feeling amongst a lot of people. He was like, I suppose today's version of Oasis in a lot of ways. He just kind of lost the run of himself while he was there. And was known for being gregarious and made a lot of enemies while he was there. And a fancying married woman apparently was one of the things as well. And in 1930s Ireland, that kind of behaviour just was not going to be acceptable at all. Yeah. So they don't talk about him much now in our draw. That's the first thing, I mean.
There's very little chat about the visit of Dylan Thomas in 1935. I suppose there'd be very little chat about anybody's visit in 1935, to be fair. The character of... There is a second character within it. It's Dylan Thomas himself and then this Liam the Post character. Yes. Explain, is this a total invention or was there a postman called Liam in Glenloch in 1935?
I'm terrified to answer that. I'm not entirely sure. All I know is that what we have is a man who was the only person who frequented him. We came up to see him and spent time with him. But unfortunately, at the same time, while he was trying to dry out, he managed to... Liam was the best pottery maker in the area. So the whole idea of the play, the whole conceit is that these two guys sit together, swap stories, drink a lot of potching and get up to mischief, a lot of mischief.
Yeah, and the mischief, and certainly in the early parts of the play you get a sense of the fun side of that and ho-ho and ha-ha. But there's a much darker side to this. In the case of both men, how the potching, the drink effectively is used as a way of not actually facing up to their demons.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you find it a lot more in the second half where Liam, as you think, is a kind of very kind of cool customer, and you find out that he fought in the First World War, and then when he got back to Ireland after the war, he ended up getting mixed up in the War of Independence and it all. And so he's got a lot of his demons to deal with as well, and they end up together trying to kind of navigate their way through their memories and the consequences, and their loneliness as well. And an awful lot of the play is about the loneliness of being an artist, of being a person looking at a blank page and setting a bar and setting a standard for yourself that you've set yourself a standard that you're going to have to reach again, and the idea of that there's no one else really there to hold your hand while you're doing it, it's a terribly tough place to be as well.
We're inclined to forget. You made the Oasis reference there earlier on, but Dylan Thomas was just 19 when he had that huge success with the initial publication. I mean, any teenager at any period in time trying to deal with the level of success, celebrity in 2024 probably isn't that different from celebrity in 1935. Is that what the play is dealing with?
Absolutely, absolutely. And even though in those times as well, being 19, a lot of, you would have been, mostly would have been married and settled down with some kind of a job and everything as well. But like 19, when that kind of greatness is thrust upon you so quickly, you know, it's very hard, unless there's someone there to protect you. Hmm. It's very hard to cope with all of that and to try and fathom what's going on and try and work out what's the truth and what's not the truth. People, is it the Emperor's new clothes or to try and decipher who's telling you the truth and who isn't.
You've referred to, you mentioned the difficult second album syndrome here. Really, that's where Dylan Thomas was at. He had to come up with these, not only the difficult second, but he also had to come up with the third book of poetry. How much is Sean Byrne really delving into the search for inspiration, the simple need for a writer to sit down at the desk and have the discipline to write day after day, and inspiration will arrive when it's ready?
It's more. I think it's kind of, because what do they say about writers? Irish writers are the cleanest houses in Ireland, because you'll do bloody anything when they sit down and start writing what you have to do. So, I think that the reason they got him there was not just to provide inspiration for him, but also to give him no other recourse only than yes. to sit in front of it and go for it and try and inspire himself and pull something out of himself, you know.
And also, I suppose there's an interesting kind of contrast here between the Liam the Post character, I mean, the postman, the most down-to-earth guy in many ways that you could find, and then the lofty heights of flights of imagination that are involved in the case of the poet. How much is Sean Byrne, the writer, playing into that, Charlie?
Oh, absolutely. There's a lovely chemistry between the two of them. It's fantastic, the pair of them, that it's very much, you know, there's a part of almost with Neil Nye in there. And, you know, there's so many different kind of relationships that we've seen over the years. Butch Cassidy's even in there as well. This kind of idea that they're great foils for each other. Because Liam would be a hell of a lot more grounded and far more country-wise as well. And you're dealing with someone who, you know, talking about clarion calls and, you know, and manages to bring him and keep his feet on the ground and try and help him through an awful lot of anxieties and fears as well. But with a lot of wicked sense of humour, very, very droll, very Donegal droll sense of humour as well.
Aidan Moriarty is playing the character of Dylan Thomas, and your fellow yes. Donegal man, Frankie McCafferty, is playing yes. the part of Liam the Post. I believe you have, I don't know if Frankie has as well, but you have moved back up home after a long time spent in Dublin. Certainly, when I knew you, Charlie, working in theatre in this part of the world. Is it possible now, and is it easier to have a career in theatre outside of the capital city?
Well, I'd already moved to Virginia. I spent 25 years in Dublin, and I moved to Virginia then for 5 years, and then I ended up moving back home after that. And, well, you know, it's like everything. I mean, there's people out there. There's an audience out there. There's no question about that. And it's wonderful to have wonderful writers like Sean and a man, Kieran Kelly from Letterkenny, too, wonderful writer. And, you know, there's fantastic talent, and technical talent here is superb as well. The facilities, you know, over the past 25 years have just got better and better. And, you know, we've got Angreen and Letterkenny, as well as the Baller and Ballybuffet as well. You know, and there's loads of venues and loads of places to expand and investigate and challenge yourselves with. So that's the plan. So hopefully over the next couple of years, we'll just keep growing and growing, and hopefully we'll put Donegal on the map on a theatrical sense again, more and more. So, excuse me, it already is on the map.
I think Brian Friel might have done a few, giving you a bit of a leg up on that one.
I heard you, man. I heard that before, that fella.
Charlie, lovely to speak with you. And I know you've had some brushes with health recently. I hope that is all cleared up and that you're in the full of yourself and that it continues in that fashion. Thanks for being with us, Charlie.
Sean, thanks so much for talking. Thank you very
much. That's Charlie Bonner, director of One Night at Glenloch, which is on at the Ballard Arts Centre in Ballybuffet on Thursday the 26th and Friday the 27th of September, Hollowira in Glencolumbkille on Saturday the 28th of September, and the Abbey Arts Centre in Ballyshannon on Sunday the 29th. Now, those of you who were around in the 80s and 90s and hung out at video rental stores might remember the phrase, be kind, rewind, a heartfelt plea for customers to do the right thing and rewind those video rental tapes before returning them. We are now in a post-videotape world, of course, a world of content abundance where you can watch whatever you want, whenever you want, and you only have to press the back arrow to get back to the beginning. But where does all of this leave the art of film programming and film festival curation? Be Kind Rewind is a new film festival taking place at the Lighthouse Cinema in Dublin. It's been curated and run by 15 graduates of a course in film curation, which ran in conjunction with the Dublin International Film Festival, Screen Ireland and Irish Film film curators, Be Kind Rewind, Kick runs this Saturday and Sunday. And here to tell me all about it and the training that went in are two of the first-time curators, Jasmine Lobos and Sean Reedy. You're both very welcome to studio
Thank
this
you.
Evening. This course that you did... did it say, here's how you put a festival together, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and that's it, you're all done now? What makes a good festival director and a curator, do you think, Jasmine?
Well, I think it's a lot about the team of people you're working with, and especially for us, the programme, we had a lot of really good supporters and also just really nice people guiding us and kind of explaining us kind of how to take the ropes, as well as anytime we sent emails or did things like that, we had like the support and overview of the team.
And how difficult, Sean, how much knowledge is necessary? I mean, you can't know every film that was ever made and where it will fit into a festival lineup. How do you marry that knowledge and go looking for films that you know nothing about and have heard nothing about?
Well, I think it's about finding a voice, to be honest, because, you know, as you mentioned, the digital abundance, it is impossible to know all these things. So it's sort of about finding the right things and connecting them to the right audience, I think.
So one of the things I think that you've done in terms of the upcoming event is over 3 days, you chose themes. Tell us about the discussions around the choosing of those themes, Sean.
Well, I don't know there was as much of a conscious decision on a theme as they sort of just fell into them. Mm. We both worked on the Sunday and it sort of has this accidental theme of flowers, both in the titles. And it's a lot more avant-garde, I think, than the other days. But there's a lot going on the other days as well. Well,
tell me then, Jasmine, if you would, how that though these films found their way into the same space and that this connecting theme of flowers then presented itself possibly after the event.
Well, for the Sunday, which is the one that connects with the flowers, I think we kind of focused on more experimental films. So it's Daisies and Funeral Parade of Roses.
Tell us a little bit about Daisies, 1966 film.
Yes, it's directed by Vera Hitlova. It's a very, well, it was a controversial film at the time because it was banned in Czechoslovakia, which was a country at the time. And it talks about these two sisters that kind of go on this journey of pranking older man for money and a lot of other kind of fun stories. And Funeral Parade of Roses is kind of an exploration of the queer scene in Japan in 1960s.
Mm-hmm. So that's the specific day that the two of you were involved in as part of the festival. Are there festivals, when you look at a particular festival around the world, the big festivals, Sean, that you would think, yeah, that one's well curated? And this one, I'm not so sure.
That's very interesting. I think there's a very interesting one in the States that's called Telluride, and it's like somewhere in the mountains in this very remote sort of skiing village, and they refuse to let anyone program anything that isn't an American premiere. So it ends up having this very eclectic, I think, way about it, rather than sort of a lot of the film festivals here. I know London is a great lineup, but it's a lot of here's a film that played 3 months ago and it's out here in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
And that's great. It's great to see that because there will be, you know, people involved in the film present, ready to speak on the film, direct to the audience, which is really valuable, I think.
Jasmine, you grew up in Malaysia, and this is in a country where censorship was quite strong, I believe, in and around the area of film. How has that fed into your own curatorship decisions?
When I look into cinema, I really like focusing on international cinema because that's the cinema I grew up with. And growing up in Malaysia, you had to be very smart about where you watched your movies and how you found them. Because a lot of if you went to the generic cinema and like these big chains, everything would be censored. And there was full scenes that were cut out. So you would kind of lose your attention to the movie.
Mm.
And I think as a curator, that has affected me in kind of like looking for the more independent, more niche kind of films and focusing on more international cinema, not just American, British, or even Irish, now that I'm here.
I mentioned the digital abundance at the beginning, Sean. To what extent has COVID made curatorship of big festivals now, where you're saying to people, get out and go to the cinema? Is that still an issue where people, send me the screen or I'll watch it at home?
Yeah, I think there is definitely an issue with that, but I think of it sort of less in terms of them as directly competing and more thinking about the cinema as more akin to live music or an art gallery.
Right.
Because, you know, you don't think of listening to an album on Spotify as the same
as going
as
to
seeing,
a gig.
seeing a gig. But at the same time, I think a lot of people now think of the cinema as only there for the big movies. And you wouldn't think of that with live music.
Yeah, you'd go to small gigs and
you'd
all.
See great small gigs, yeah.
Okay. Well, listen, thanks both for coming in, Sean Reedy and Jasmine Lobosch. Be Kind Rewind takes place this coming Friday, Saturday and Sunday at the Lighthouse Cinema. You'll find out full information on DIFF, Dublin International Film Festival, .ie. Tonight's competition, 1993 film version of Much Ado About Nothing, Denzel Washington, Keanu Reeves, Emma Thompson, among many others, starred. Which Belfast-born Oscar-winning screenwriter and actor adapted the play for the screen, directed the film? Should ask our two curators that. Kenneth Branagh is the answer, and Jacqueline Howard from Lisarda in Lisarda. I don't know where the emphasis is there, Jacqueline. You're in County Cork anyway, and you'll know where you're from, and you'll know that you're going to that event. Enjoy it on Tuesday the 1st of October. Performance of Beatrice and Benedict with Fiona Shaw as narrator and Irish mezzo-soprano Paula Murray. That is our lot for this Monday evening. Leah Murphy researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.